This is File 10, Cycle 3. This is Jean McMillan. Today's date is November 16th, 2017. I am interviewing Lynn Riefschneider. She's going to talk about her grandfather, who was a collier on Mount Riga, and she's going to talk about Pony Club, growing up in town, and anything else that tickles her fancy. But first, we'll start with the genealogical information. What is your name?
My name is Lynn Rebelard Riefschneider.
And when were you born?
June 20th, 1947, in Hartford, a month early.
Good for you.
I made it.
You did.
I did.
Your parents' names, please.
My dad was Paul Rebelard, native of Salisbury. My mom was Esther Strauss Rebelard, born in Meriden, Connecticut.
And do you have siblings?
I have one older brother, Paul Rebelard Jr., but he goes by Bing.
And when you were growing up, where did you live in town?
We lived right off of Route 44, just before the intersection with Taconic. It was Esther's Package Store that my dad ran and named after my mom.
Ah.
And it's now the B&B.
It's now Sassafras, and it's run by Peter Oliver and his wife, Sandy Gomez.
Sandy Gomez, right.
Now, you had some grandparents. First of all, what were their names?
Well, the ones here in Salisbury was Ernest Frederick Rebelard, and his wife was Julia Bonatel.
Ah!
Rebelard.
Okay. And did they live up on Mount Riga?
They did indeed. They did indeed. My granddad was born in France, little town Chenonbier, France.
You'll have to spell that one.
And I have no clue.
Okay.
You'll have to ask Rich how to spell it. He is the French scholar.
All righty.
And when he was a young lad, he was born in October of 1858. And when he was a young lad, he and five other young boys from his town were put on a ship to go to America to make a better life. Some of those, and my dad knew all the names, but Gablo was one. They ended up, you know, in Sharon. And Goo, G-O-U-X, was another name. And I'm not sure the other ones. Daddy always knew that. Mm-hmm. And this was just, you know, things that Daddy told me, because my granddad died before I was born, long before I was born. Mm-hmm. So that's from Daddy. But my grandfather came to the United States and entered through New York and ended up on the mountain, and he was a collier there.
And what does a collier do?
A collier creates charcoal.
And there's a whole process.
There is a skill. Daddy said it was the most artistic thing he had ever seen. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Because apparently you had to chop down the right kind of trees at the right age of tree and cut it into 4 foot long pieces of wood and then artfully make a circle with these things, leaning them up so air could get in, but not too much air. And the thing would grow to be about 12 or 13 feet high and anywhere from 20 to 30 feet in diameter. And after the wood was skillfully placed, not toppling in or a little goofy, they would put sod on it and leaves and then burn it in such a way that the wood wouldn't fully engulf and just have it go just so far so that the end result was charcoal. And Daddy said that there were some people that were so creative. He always called it a creative process,
it
was tough, tough work.
Oh, yeah.
But you could get the pieces of charcoal and break it open and see the grain of the wood so Ooh. That you could identify
the type of wood.
The type of wood and the age of the wood.
Ooh.
And it was a huge industry up there. And apparently, charcoal is very light, so they would have these horse-drawn or mule-drawn carts and stack the charcoal up on it. And it would be, Daddy was just a little kid, and he was observing this. So he said halfway to heaven, these things would tower, and then it would be drawn to wherever it was needed. So for his 80th birthday, my dad's 80th birthday, he wanted to climb Bear Mountain one more time. So we did. Rich, me, my brother and his kids, we all went up. And Daddy could still point out places where charcoal had been made by looking at round stands of trees and all of that. So it was not only an effort in energy, but it was a trip for Dad down memory lane and see and identify all these kinds of things. And we learned a lot by listening to Daddy.
There were no trees from here to Pittsfield. It was a 40.
It was denuded.
It was denuded. But it was an art to do these mounds of wood. And they had to be careful that they left air holes, and sometimes they have to go on the top of them to open air holes so that the wood wouldn't burn totally. Not something I would have wanted to do.
Hard work, hard work. But Dad also said that the people that did it, it was sort of like a fraternity.
They would
help each other out. There wasn't competition per se, but if somebody needed something or somebody was sick and they would really pitch in together.
Now, was your father born on Mount Riga?
No. Daddy was born up in Taconic, Chapinville at the time, I believe. And in the house, and I don't know who owns it now, but when I was growing up, it was owned by Joe and Britton Henning. And if you're Henning, H-E-N-N-I-N-G, Swedes. And there was a little Norwegian-Swedish community in town that you might enjoy learning about. But if you go up to Conic and pass where Camp Everett used to be, and you're going up those little rolling hills, and Elsa's Kitchen used to be on the left.
Yes.
And the dirt road just before Elsa's Kitchen.
On the left or the right?
On the left. It goes up a little hill, maybe a quarter of a mile or so, maybe not that long. But there's a house up there, and that was, my dad was born in the front bedroom. And my folks were friends with Joe and Britton, so I remember lots of things up there. But I would always go in the room where my dad was born. Every time we visited.
Sure.
And I just thought that was pretty cool that I could in the room that Daddy was born in.
Oh, that's nifty.
Yeah, it was.
That's nifty. And your father married whom?
Esther Strauss.
Okay.
Rebelard. And she came as a very young, young school teacher and taught in the old school up in Taconic, which was built by the Scoville family for the
Children of the community.
Of the community.
Okay. How did your parents, I know that they met, but their first date, you were telling me about their first date.
Well, what I thought was kind of fun, Daddy was working on, there used to be a community or a chapel there on that little triangle.
Yeah, Union Chapel.
Union Chapel, and Daddy was shingling the roof.
My brother-in-law used to preach there on Sundays.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that was Henry Chiaro.
That's cool. Well, Daddy was shingling the roof, and at that time the trees were much smaller than they are now, and he viewed what he thought was this really kind of cool-looking school lady going back and forth. She lived in the with the O'Neills at the time, in the White House right next to it. And so Daddy checked that out and after a while had enough nerve to ask the lady, who would be my mom, out for a date. And they went blueberry picking up on Mount Riga for their first date. And Daddy, I guess in his younger years, was a bit of a dude. Not necessarily bright, but a bit of a dude because he wore light slacks to go blueberry picking. And my mom would laugh still. I mean, years after Daddy had died, telling about this, how Daddy's slacks were just a mess.
Oh, blueberries. Yes. Juice said they were never, ever able to get out.
Oh. But that was their first date, and they went up on the mountain to pick blueberries. And then they came back and made blueberry pie with Mrs. O'Neill. I don't know if you ever knew her. Supervision.
No. I didn't know her. One of the teachers that I worked with at Salisbury Central, Dot Love, used to live with her during the winter, so she didn't have to go back to Great Barrington.
Ah.
So I know the name anyway.
Yeah. All under right. her supervision. I guess I was just a little kid when all of that happened, but I guess she was tough and supervised
a lot. I've heard from others that she was one tough cookie. Now, you were born, you grew up in town, and you were a pony club participant.
I was. I didn't start that, though, until sixth grade. One of the things that is deceptive about growing up in Salisbury, if somebody were just driving through, they think it's a little sleepy kind of town. It is a bubbling hotbed of all sorts of things, cultural, political, whatever.
Yep.
And one of my mom and dad's things as parents was to expose both my brother and myself to all sorts of stuff. So until sixth grade, I took art lessons with George Bear here in the library. And I took ballet with Helen Haynes in Sharon. Those were...
Helen Haynes?
Haynes. H-A-I-N-E-S. And those
did
were,
she become Helen Townsend later?
I have no idea.
I think so, because she was a ballet teacher in Sharon at the time that I knew.
A lovely, graceful lady
yep.
with a wonderful smile
and
a very soft voice. Well, that was wasted money for my folks because I had no talent in either. And so by sixth grade, I was able to convince my mom that was money just down the drain, and I really, really, really wanted to ride horses. And so
they
gave up. They saw the fruits of my effort, and they gave up, and they let me join the pony club that was over on Lucy Drummond's on Route 41 with my friend Kathy Coons and I. We joined at the same time, and Kathy and I, her dad worked for Edith Scovel on that property. He was the farmer there, and Kathy and I would ride our bikes faithfully from our homes every Saturday morning over for lessons at the pony club. And we both stuck with it all through high school. And
was Kathy with a K or a C?
A K.
I always ask. What did you actually do with pony club besides ride horses?
Well, in the beginning, you just took lessons to learn how to ride. But Pony Club is a wonderful organization that not only has you learning skills to be a responsible, competent rider, but you learned horse management, farm management, the anatomy of the horse, how to take care of, responsible ownership, things about hunting, manners of hunting and how, you know, fox hunting came to be. So there was a history involved. It was kind of a total look at horse industry, horse management, love of horses. It was great.
When you were taking Pony Club lessons, did you have written exams at that time?
Yes. Oh, yes.
That surprised me.
Oh, yes. That's how you went. You start off on the D level. And then you work your way up toward an A. And within each level, there's 1, 2, 3s, and 4s. So it was very regimented, so to speak, very developmental, if you want to use educational language. And you studied. You had this little green book, and you studied, and you read, and they were written exams. So you were not only graded on your knowledge, but your writing ability and stable management ability and knowledge and responsibility level. It was quite a comprehensive thing, and it was wonderful, just wonderful.
Well, it wasn't superficial then, was it?
No.
Not in any way. No.
And it wasn't for a lackey either. You worked hard. Many a parent said to those of us over there, if you only worked hard at home or in school, you should work over at Lucy's. You know,
yes, but you liked what you were doing at Lucy's.
It was great. It was great.
What is eventing?
Eventing is 3-day. Well, it can be 3-day or it can be a smaller unit of time, but it's basically three different events: dressage, cross country, and stadium event jumping. And those involve very different disciplines and abilities, and it's quite challenging. It is exciting, and you have to be fairly competent to be involved in that kind of thing. And all those events require different skills of horse and rider, but it is the same horse and rider that participates in those three events.
What's cross country? We'll start with that one.
Cross country is a defined course, defined in both mileage that you travel, distance, and the amount of time that a horse and rider can do that safely. Okay. And there is parts of it that's on the flat, and there are a series of jumps. Jumps over water, jumps up banks, jumps over created different types of wooden structures or stone walls. And it is awesome fun.
Horse knows enough to go over the...
Well, that's the communication part between you and horse, which is developed over time.
What is dressage?
Dressage is a very different kind of discipline. It is all done on the flat. It is done in a more collected way. Hopefully, the communication between horse and rider is invisible, but it's happening all the time. And again, the different levels, and that started on C. I don't remember dressage being offered on a D level. You're just learning the basics on the D level.
Yeah.
But the C level, and you would enter a defined space, and things would be marked out with letters, A, B, C, D, E, F, and G, I believe. X is in the middle. And you would have a prescribed route to follow. You would walk in, go to the center point, which I believe was X, drop your hand, salute the judges, and then proceed. And you would go either left or right, and you would do collected trots, extended trots, collected canter, extended canters. You would do turns on the foreleg, and if you got a little better, turns on the hindquarters. It was very defined. And again, that was judged every second that you're in the ring. Both horse and rider are judged. Very structured, very elegant, very lovely, done well.
Are you using an English or a Western saddle?
Oh, wait, all of these events, English.
English. Okay.
And a different gear, too. The rider doing dressage is... when you get good at it, top hat and tails and gloves.
Yeah.
And it's very elegant and very poshy. Different saddle, if you're wealthy enough to have a different saddle. Mm-hmm. It's a flatter saddle. The leg is further back in the saddle, so you have more contact
with the horse
and your whole leg, because signals are given through your butt, your hands, and your legs.
All righty.
Invisibly, if you're good.
Did you take care of just one horse? I mean, was that your horse that you took care of, or did you do all of them?
You reached a certain point, at least with Lucy's, and different stables do things differently, but there were a number of us, and we took care of all the horses, and she had an excess of 70. We let them out, we brought them in, we groomed them, we fed them. We did haying for her. I mean, we were the worker bees.
Oh, yeah.
Supervised by John Clark and Lucy. But generally, when it came to showing and riding and going to the Pony Club rallies, everybody pretty much had their favorite horse.
Yeah.
And it wasn't written in stone, but most of us got to ride our favorite horses because not only did that work for harmony and stuff, but you generally, if you had a favorite horse, you rode that horse and you built up that trust and relationship. Sure. So everything worked better.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. It would.
Everything
it
worked
would.
Better.
It would.
So that's how it went. But the final determination was done by Lucy, who rode what when.
She would.
Yeah.
She
that's would. Her. That was her property.
Yeah.
These are valuable, expensive
oh, yeah.
items.
Yeah.
And although we had a great deal of fun, it
was work.
It was work. And it was always, you couldn't be reckless with it. You
no.
had to be mindful and responsible.
Yeah, well, that was the lessons that were being taught.
Oh, my gosh, yes.
And obviously, they stuck.
Yeah.
Why do you love horses so? Do you know?
Well, I'm an animal nut, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
Ask my husband and my kids. And that's, I think, what starts this.
Sure.
But I think there's a mystery about the horse itself.
Mm-hmm.
And so you might be drawn to horses, but it's not just, oh, I love cats, oh, I love dogs. It goes beyond that.
Yeah.
For most of us who have stuck with it through the years, and unfortunately I'm not riding now, but I was able to pick it up after a hiatus of 40 years. And it's almost a spiritual relationship between horse and rider. Back in Virginia, I was able to ride one horse
mm-hmm.
a lot,
mm-hmm.
and we trusted one another. We really began to think like a team, and
mm-hmm.
his name was Doolin. He was part Connemara, part Thoroughbred, and he looked out for me, and he knew me well enough to know that I would never put him in a situation that we could be hurt or, you know, that we couldn't handle.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
was my responsibility in that. And we really worked as a team. And as I say, it's a spiritual oneness besides just having the privilege
yeah.
to be in that kind of close relationship
yeah.
with another being.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this one has 4 legs and a tail, but a wonderful heart.
Yeah.
And anybody, I think, that rides horses enough cannot ride horses without knowing the heart of the horse and the mind. And that goes beyond just sitting on a thing and making
yeah.
it go fast.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You have to have trust with the animal that you're working with, and they have to have trust in you, too.
Yeah. So it really does transcend
mm-hmm.
the event, and then you're outside in God's creation, which is beautiful,
mm-hmm.
and the wind going through you and seeing all the changes of nature and all of that. It's just an incredible
experience.
Beyond experience, privilege.
Well done. Well done. I want to go on to the art lessons with George Bear. Just, you know, what did he look like? What did he teach?
Oh, he was a little man,
mm-hmm.
and he had flowing, he looked like an artiste.
Ah.
He was little, he had a little bit of a tummy. He always wore a white shirt and slacks. His hair was sort of longish,
mm-hmm.
not hippie-ish, but
longer
it was,
than...
It was curly. Like,
yeah.
my dad's hair was always clipped short.
Yeah.
Mr. Bear's was curly-ish.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And when you would see him about town, he always wore a little beret,
oh,
artfully
good.
Cocked to the side. And it was dark blue
mm-hmm.
or black. It was a dark one. And he would wear a scarf. So he was sort of natty. He was, but he also just had a heart of gold. And probably transformed more pictures than mine into something that was respectable. My efforts, I mean, and I had no talent. And he was, oh, very good, Lynn, very good. Soft and encouraging.
Mm-hmm.
And then he would take a few splashes of paint and a brush, and it would actually look okay.
Yeah.
It didn't
yeah.
look like mine,
but
it was
okay.
It
yeah.
was okay.
Yeah.
You come home with this kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I would say, and this was Saturday morning, again, before I learned how to go to, that I could go to the horses, but there were probably 10 to 12 of us in there at a time, and I don't know how many classes he had in a week, but I would ride down with the Durst family, with Barb and Joan, and Eleanor Durst was the driver, and Eleanor would drive us down, and then my mom would pick us up and deliver us off. The Dursts had talent. I had none.
I've been there. I understand.
And my brother also took lessons for a while, and he had some ability. None. I see things afterwards that I say, oh, this looks nice, but I can't create it.
We're gifted in different ways.
Yeah.
Tell me about Helen Haynes.
Before I get to that, it always smelled, when you opened the door, and this was before all the library looked differently then.
Oh, yes.
But it was wonderful because you opened the door and you smelled the oil paints.
Ah.
And it was a great, it was fun. I mean, I had no talent, but it was still fun. And he was such a gentleman, the gentleman, that you never, I mean, I knew, but he never would say, oh, Lynn, maybe this should be your last lesson.
Yeah. He was a gentleman, and he was careful not to bruise the ego.
Exactly, exactly.
Good man.
He was a good man. Helen Haynes was a lovely lady, and she was a lady. She even walked gracefully. And she had a number of classes, and you started with, you know, just little ballet shoes. I eventually did get into toe, but I didn't have much talent for that because I'm not the most graceful thing. And most dancers are long and lean and elegantly kind of, even just in how they walk. And I'm a tomboy. I'm in there. But
that's okay.
But I do have rhythm, and I do love music, so that did help me a little bit. But those lessons, again, she started with young people, and there were recitals at the end which would showcase, you know, all kids, all levels of ability.
And how many were in the class that you
were in? I'm going to say about 8 to 10. And it was in the, it was in two places, actually. One is, because she moved. One is you're going into Sharon, I think became like a garage after that.
It was by Autosport. It was the building right next to Autosport.
Okay, and on the other side of the road, a building that is near the school, a white building. And I was in both places because I did it maybe 4 or 5 years with her. And she, too, was very encouraged. She was tough.
You have to be.
She was tough. And she would, you know, straighten up, heads up, shoulders down. But she was never unkind.
There's a difference.
Never unkind.
Yeah.
And just a lovely lady. And every once in a while, we would sort of cajole or tease, please, dance for us.
Yeah.
And we would sit on the floor, and she would do so. And she was marvelous. Just marvelous. And the music was on a record player.
Oh, yes.
If you remember what that is.
I have one. And I still play records.
Oh, my. But that was fun, and that was good to do.
Now, when did you start going to sock hops?
Oh, you're only allowed to go as 7th and 8th graders.
That's what I thought.
7th and 8th graders at the Grove. And it was organized by Mr. Hemmerly, Wilbert Hemmerly.
Yep.
And he, at the time, was athletic director. I think that might have been his title.
Yep.
There was a waiting period for that. So that was pretty cool when you got to be a 7th grader.
Ooh.
And high school kids were not allowed. It was just 7th and 8th grade.
Did you go with a group of girls?
Oh, sure. Again, everything was carpooled.
Yeah.
And, your best friends, you all went. And for a while, the girls were on one side and the boys, and then you sort of,
What was
tear
the time
a little bit.
Frame? Was it like from 7 to 9?
It was Friday nights, and it was 7 to 9, and refreshments were available for purchase. Every once in a while, there might be hot dogs there, too, but it was mostly like chips and soda, that kind of thing. Sometimes parents would provide cupcakes if you were really lucky.
Ooh, but not often.
Not all the time.
Now, you told me the last time that you remembered all of your Salisbury Central School teachers.
I do.
Would you mind going through the list before we go on to high school?
Okay. My kindergarten teacher was Mrs. Condon, and Miss Condon. She was from Canaan. And then I had Mrs. McKee, Mrs. Matheson, Mrs. Lemoyne, Miss Crapser, and she taught fourth grade. She had a sister that taught sixth grade, but they only were there for 1 or 2 years. Mrs. Ohlendorf, a delight, wonderful
you like her.
Lady. I loved her, Ilsa Ohlendorf. And that fifth grade year, two new girls came into my class, and they became my best friends. Dee Dee Warner, Edith Church Warner, it's a family name here, and then Pam Dunning.
How do you spell Pam's last name?
D-U-N-N-I-N-G.
All right. Sixth grade you had?
Sixth grade I had Mrs. Kelly. Seventh grade, Betty Miner. Eighth grade, Elizabeth Gandelli.
Terrific.
Music teachers were Mr. Meter and Mr. Garavoy.
Oh, my word.
Philip Garavoy.
Philip Garavoy, I remember him.
Yep, yep, from Sharon. Mm-hmm. Mr. Nania, because not everybody stayed all through there,
yep.
From Canaan. And you know what? There was a lady that I had 1 year that I really liked a lot. She came from Cornwall, and I can't remember her name.
Well, we'll let you off the hook on that one.
Yeah. She was just there a year, like my seventh grade year, I think. Sixth grade year. Lower building. One other thing about school, if I can.
Yes.
Our grade was the first kindergarten grade in the new building.
Oh, okay.
The very first. And it was all-day kindergarten.
Oh, that's a long day. That's a long day for a little kid.
You know,
you didn't
we took a nap. We had
yeah.
to bring our little things to put on the floor, so yeah. we napped afterwards. And sometimes you'd conk off, and sometimes not. You'd have eyes open, see if
yeah.
it's resting or not.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was never a good napper. When did you join Salisbury Band?
I joined Salisbury Band when I was in second grade,
mm-hmm.
the summer of my second grade year. And I had started trumpet at the beginning of my second grade year, which was a little early. Mr. Meter was the teacher, and I had been begging to play a musical instrument. It had to be trumpet, because at that point in time, our family lived on the bottom floor of our house, and my folks rented out the top floor. And they rented it out to Georgie Crawford. Her husband was in the Army and away, and she had a son, Kenny, who was 4 years older than me, same age as my brother,
mm-hmm.
and he played trumpet.
Uh-huh.
So that's how I could hear the trumpet, and I wanted to play trumpet like Kenny.
Okay.
So my first instrument was trumpet. And I had to go to the dentist, Dr. Barr, to make sure that my teeth and my jaw were formed enough that I wouldn't do damage to that development. And Dr. Barr said, oh, that'd be great. So I started trumpet. And then that summer, I was allowed to march with the band. So that's how I started.
You were one of the younger ones.
I was the youngest one. They had to order a special uniform for me, and that was funny. At those days, the band marched a lot of places with the firemen.
Yep.
Firemen marched in parades. There were fire women's parades in all the small towns, but we went as far as Beacon, we went to Kingston, we went to the Chatham Fair, Amenia, Red Hook, Pine Plains, all of those places, not just Sharon, Falls Village, Lakeville, Canaan, but all over by bus. And some of those were long for a little kid.
Oh, yeah.
Like 5 miles, 6 miles. On hot days in those old wool uniforms, it was rugged.
What did the uniforms look like?
They were black pants with a red stripe going down the side with a gold cord on the outside. All wool.
Oh, gee.
And you wore black shoes, black socks. And then you wore a white dress shirt because you wore a black tie,
four in hand.
And then you had a red, basically red wool jacket, black cuff, black collar, gold trim, an epaulette, and a gold braid that went around, and a patch that they still wear for the band. And you had a black military army hat with a little insignia on the top. Wow. It was quite military, and you wore it whether it was 90 degrees or 50 degrees. And they held up many a year. Somewhere along the line, on really, really, really hot days, they got ugly blue shirts. They were gray with the insignia, and you wore the gray shirt with the tie and the hat. But the jacket, thankfully, was left behind because it was brutal sometimes.
It would be. Was Bill Meader the director of the band?
Yes.
Okay.
He was not the original director, but he did it for many a year. Many a year. And Jimmy Du Bois was the main honcho drummer. My mom was treasurer for a good 20 years or so. In the good years and the lean years, because like anything else, there are ebbs and flows to everything.
And you had a wonderful story about Jack Rogers.
Jack Rogers was a gem. Jack Rogers played bass drum. And on some of the longer ones, and hot, I couldn't do it. And at one point in the Chatham Fair, you had to sort of scoot through a field to get from where you were going to where you needed to be. And Jack would hoist me up on his shoulders, and he's bass drum, and I'm on Jack's shoulders because I could not walk at all.
No.
And he was great. He looked out. The band experience was nothing but positive for me. And I kept up with it to after I was married. Our first home was in a little town called Scaticook, New York, outside of Troy.
Yeah.
I still came back for the parades and all of that. And so from second grade to 32, when we moved down to Princeton, I was still playing in the band all those years.
Good for you. Good for you. No, it was something you loved to do.
I did love it, and I felt a responsibility because, as I said, there were lean years. So I played everything from trumpet, French horn, baritone, snare drum, bass drum, cymbals, bells, the glockenspiel. Sort of what was needed at the time, and sometimes I didn't even know what I was going to be playing till I showed up. It was funny. But Mr. Meader said, "Hey, Lynn, can you think you could?" I said, "I think I can."
Did you ever have private music lessons other than the band?
Oh yeah, second grade on, all the way through. I played instruments in college, too. So I had private lessons all the way through second grade and high school with Mr. Meader. And I basically switched my major instruments to boiling it down to cello and French horn. And I played those through college. But coming back, moving back to Salisbury has enabled me to pick up the baritone again. So I play our son's baritone. Because both of our boys, when they Came home baritone, with those little things.
Baritone what?
Baritone horn. It's a horn you wrap your arms around. It's not a tuba, not as big as a tuba. Not a sousaphone with a big circular thing that you put your body into, but you hold it on your lap and the bell is pointed forward.
I did French horn for about 2 years. That was it. Reminiscences of high school.
For me, it was a very positive thing. It was great meeting kids from the other towns, and that was a fun thing. Mm-hmm. Whole new set of friends and everything. It was also fun for me to hear horror stories about kids who had my mother as a teacher in Falls Village, because my mom was an excellent teacher, but she was of the old school, and there was order, there was structure, there were manners.
Yeah, I get the same
thing. There
were
expectations, and she was the one of the ones that the kids would love to go back and talk to.
I get the same thing doing the oral histories with a lot of my kids, that, boy, you were tough, but I learned a lot.
Right, right. And she taught first and second grade for years and years and years, over 30 years at Lee Kellogg, and then she ended up doing math for 7th and 8th graders in Canaan, maybe the last 10 years of her career. And she taught for 46 years. So she had a lot of kids, and she always knew their names.
Oh, yes.
When she would see them afterwards, and she could tell you where they sat in the classroom. She was great.
I can come up with a family, usually.
Yeah.
But if there were five or six kids in the family, I may not get the right name.
Right. And in her day, she taught all the disciplines, but also art and music, and she was out at research.
Yeah.
You know, elementary teachers didn't get planned periods and didn't get to eat with their kids.
That was the way I was trained.
Right.
To be able to do art, music, and gym with the kids.
Right.
When I came to Salisbury Central in 67, I didn't have to do that. But I was trained that way.
Right. That's the way it was.
But Connecticut didn't have a register.
Mm-hmm.
In Massachusetts, you had a register.
Ah.
And that was a piece of work. That was a piece of work. Do you remember Barnett's store at Christmas time?
Oh, loved it. You get to go up to the second floor to meet Santa.
Yes.
And see the train that they had and all the things that potentially could be underneath your tree at Christmas time.
Ah.
Yes.
Do you remember visiting with Santa?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Scariest thing that I ever did in the beginning. But then once you knew it was Mr. Barnett, it was a piece of cake.
I thought it was Bill Rainsford.
And it was also, I was going to say, it was also Judge Rainsford. So, depending on the hour of the day and day of the week sometimes, they did go back and forth.
Okay, alrighty.
And you could tell by the size.
Oh, yeah.
Mr. Rainsford was a little round, and Bill Barnett
was kind of thin.
He was thin.
Thin.
Tall, thin.
Do you remember if Santa Claus recorded your requests in a book?
If he did, I don't remember that.
Okay, because I've heard that he did.
I do not remember that.
I've heard that he did, and we cannot find those books.
And I was always nervous doing that.
Mm-hmm. I can
so,
understand that.
So, I don't remember.
Okay, that was an off-the-wall question.
Right.
What else would you like to tell me about your growing up in Salisbury that I haven't covered?
Looking back at it, you know, being 70 plus now, and having talked with lots of people and friends from all over the country, I realized just how special a place Salisbury is. I said earlier it looked sleepy, but you know what? I was not denied any opportunity. And my folks were not the wealthy folks. But I realized that they made parenting a priority. Mm-hmm. So Bing and I were exposed to a lot. It was just a good time to grow up. I don't think I had fears of the world. Even in high school, none of my friends had cars or access
to
cars.
No.
The only kids that really drove cars were those that were in the ag courses and stuff, and they could drive. If we went any place, it was on our bikes, and there was no notion that it wasn't safe to be at the other end of town or other. You know, I rode my bike from my house to Lucy's, my bike to the Grove to swim, rode to Canaan. I mean, I was a candy striper in high school. I rode my bike to Sharon. And there wasn't a notion that people weren't going to look out for you. Everybody As a matter of fact, it was the flip side when I was allowed to drive the family car. If I was going too fast, my folks would have four calls before I got home saying, Solin going by. So people looked out and knew everybody.
Oh, yeah.
And so for me, it was a great experience. And that was one reason why I extracted the promise from my husband, I'll go anywhere we need to go, but when we retire, I want to go back home to Salisbury.
Wonderful. Thank you so much for your reminiscences.
You're more than welcome. It's my pleasure.